Let's go ahead and bring up Jason for one more. Let's give him a hand.
Well, how's everyone doing? Has this been a good day? Good, good. I'll say this before we jump in, and I've probably said it in different ways, and I might say it again. One thing I look forward to is families like ourselves and others spread across this nation. So the themes we're talking about today, on the one hand, you have biblical theological understanding that we need to grow into, and on the other aspect, there are applications, practical applications, that we need to be implementing in our own families, but also with, and this is with other families, which is a particular area that I want to cultivate is how do we get different families to work together on some of these things. And in one sense, these are new things we're creating. So maybe on a principle level, it might be bringing back in the past, but we got to be creating some new institutions and whatnot. Someone mentioned, Gary, your family using technology. I think that'd be something we can, you know, need to use as families to work together. So excited to do that with you guys in the future. Okay, so building generational family wealth. So here, I'm going to start off with this caveat, this qualification as we launch into this subject. I'm not pretending that I have personal expertise in this area from experience. What I'm sharing with you this morning or today is what I've learned from actually wealthy, the ultra high net worth families, the multi-generational families, what they teach and do. Okay. So this is an area where we have to especially have to remember we are talking about a multi-generational reality rather than, in contrast to that, a mono-generational one. So there are going to be things that we talk about that apply to a multi-generational family's finances that don't necessarily apply to an individual household family on a mono-generational basis. So it's important to keep that distinction in mind. In some cases, there's distinctions. I'm not going to read this. I'm just going to have you look over this to get a feel for where the different subjects that we're going to be looking at today. So just an outline of topics that we'll be covering. That last one on there, I'm particularly excited to talk about this last subject. And I have that called a proto-family office. If you've never heard that term before, there's a good reason. So I made it myself. I made it up myself just a little over a year ago. So it's a new concept that I'm working on exploring, and you guys are the lucky guinea pig audience that I get to test it out on. So thank you. So even if you disagree with it, I think you'll find it fascinating and might be good subject matter for later. All right. Oops. Yeah. Moving on to our first point, unrighteous versus righteous pursuit of wealth. So this distinction between a righteous versus an unrighteous pursuit of wealth needs to be clear in the minds of families if they want to build a multi-generational line. Because the scripture gives clear warnings about the dangers of riches, many Christians have taken a posture that the spiritually safe bet is to not pursue substantive wealth at all. The problem with this is that a proper distinction is not being made. What is condemned in Scripture is an unrighteous pursuit of wealth. If you take this and apply a principle of absolutely no pursuit of wealth, you will violate other scriptural principles that clearly imply a righteous pursuit of wealth. The book of Proverbs, for example, over and over again teaches that one result of wise living is the accumulation of wealth. It's just a byproduct of wisdom. So if you're going to pursue some pietistic philosophy of no wealth building, well, then according to Proverbs, you'd better commit yourself to remaining a fool. So you see the contradictions you can get yourself into. Wealth is the fuel of the family mission. And when we talk about building wealth in the context of multi-generational families, we are not talking about individual wealth, but rather family wealth, wealth that belongs to the whole family. The fact is, your multi-generational family must pursue wealth. And of course, we are assuming in a righteous manner. If you don't, that is, if you don't pursue family wealth, you will cut off the fuel of the family and the multi-generational mission will be starved and it will eventually die. It is a false piety, a kind of Gnosticism that says, quote-unquote, the spiritual things in our human earthly world can live without the body, without material means. All the criticisms of fleshly and earthly and worldly things in the Bible are not criticisms of those things in and of themselves. They are criticisms of making those things idols. Because fallen man wrongly worships the creation rather than the creator, that does not make the creation bad. It is the wrongly directed worship that's bad. God tells us in Genesis 1 that his creation is good. So, while the material wealth of the family is not the goal, it is a necessary tool to serve the family's mission. So, now assuming we're agreed that we must pursue material wealth as part of what it means to be a multi-generational family, our next point is going to seem a little paradoxical. And we talked about this during the break as well. So the uniform consensus among all the writers on multi-generational families, this is uniform consensus on this. The factors that most determine the success of building and preserving the economic or material wealth in the long term are not directly economic and financial issues. So here's a quote from James Hughes Jr. He says, very few families have understood that their wealth consists of three forms of capital, human, intellectual, and financial. Even fewer families have understood that without active stewardship of their human and intellectual capital, they cannot preserve their financial capital. In my opinion, the issue most critical to the failure of a family to preserve its wealth is concentration on the family's financial capital to the exclusion of its human and intellectual capital. In fact, this concentration on financial capital may even cause it to go out of business in just one generation. And here in another passage, he says this, with growth of human and intellectual capital comes a high probability of growth of financial capital. Without growth of human and intellectual capital, financial capital may still grow, but it will not matter to the family's ability to preserve its wealth over the long term. Since the family will go out of business as its human assets become less and less valuable. So the point here is that multi-generational families must follow the paradox of focusing on non-economic assets, things like what we talked about in the previous session on building your family culture, if you want to produce greater economic wealth over time. And later we'll see more why this is the case. Okay, stewards versus owners. So members of multi-generational families need to have a stewardship mentality over a personal ownership mentality. This doesn't mean individuals don't have real legal personal ownership over what has been entrusted to them, but individual households need to regard their owned assets in terms of stewardship for the covenantal family first and foremost before they think of it as a source of expenditure on their own individual wants and desires. Apart from the stewardship mentality, thinking in terms of, I'm going to move this along here, thinking in terms of personal money rather than family money will have a dissipating effect on the family wealth over time. So listen to this quote from Bill and Will Bonner, their book Family Fortunes. Family money is very different from the cash that individuals have in the bank. Members of successful old money families think of themselves as stewards, not owners, of their financial capital. Personal money is ready to do almost anything, anytime, anywhere, provided it is able. That is the trouble with personal money. There's almost no service to which it might not be put. Personal money is not meant to outlast the job it is meant to perform. For most people, that job ends when they do. We're talking about a different kind of money, family money. It belongs to a family, but to no one in particular. Like all institutional money, it has people who are in charge of it, as people who are supposed to make sure that it doesn't disappear, and other people who are supposed to make sure it grows if possible. These people are not supposed to spend it on themselves. There's another stewardship mentality, is that every generation needs to think of itself as the quote-unquote first generation. And so what do I mean by this? So later we'll be looking briefly, talking about trust real briefly, but ask yourself this: what is the assumption of your typical scenario of that second generation of adult children who inherit a bunch of money from wealthy parents? We call them trust fund babies. And they typically spend it on their living expenses. Well, it is not so with us. For covenantal families, individual members must add to the collective wealth of the family rather than subtract from it. Each generation is to assume it is the first generation, so to speak, again, in terms of wealth creation. Each individual member needs to have a producer mentality rather than a consumer mentality. Now, while growing wealth and preserving wealth are two distinct disciplines, for multi-generational families particularly, they must grow their wealth over time if they want to preserve it. There's no such thing as a place of unending static equilibrium. And here's what a quote from Hughes, he talks about this. He says, any family whose wealth of human, intellectual, and financial capital is simply maintaining value rather than growing is either in a danger of entering a state of decay or entropy. A family, like any investor, must maximize its return on capital if it is to achieve the growth necessary for preservation over a long period of time. Okay, we got a big paradox here that we're going to be talking about. This was a subject in the different ways I've been talking with some of you in between the breaks as well. This paradox of what I'm coining another a phrase contrast here between entrepreneurial culture versus a culture of entrepreneurs. So this is a new phrase I'm entertaining for talking about the needed business mindset for multi-generational families. Again, there's this phrase, multi-generational families need to build an entrepreneurial culture, but not necessarily a culture of entrepreneurs. That's for every family in every case. So what do I mean by this? Well, we'll start with the second half of the phrase, a culture of entrepreneurs. For those of us who listen to leaders who talk about multi-generational families, we have definitely heard the exhortation to encourage our sons to pursue entrepreneurial vocations. And I agree with this, but with certain qualifications. There are certainly many advantages to being a family of business owners. But the question is, should we encourage or expect that each one of our sons pursue entrepreneur business ownership regardless of their particular temperament and gifting, regardless of their season in life, and regardless of what's going on in the broader economy? Now, I'm honestly not fully convinced on this question, but I'm becoming more persuaded that there can be dangers in encouraging each of our sons to assume the role of business owners irrespective of those other considerations, or maybe not business owners, but like substantive, like wealth founders beyond the normal. Maybe I'm not addressing people in this crowd, but I know the crowds that I walk with, there is a tendency to emphasize this, and it can be taken too far. So I'll share a quote in a moment that supports that perspective. But first, let's discuss what I mean by an entrepreneurial culture. By entrepreneurial culture, I mean that the family as a whole is business-minded or producer-minded. So I have a couple of suggestions or ideas for how this might apply to a family. So first, I think this implies that employees, as long as we're in employee status, that we employees should still think and act in a business owner perspective or mindset as far as it is possible. So for example, for we employees, and this is a question, a rhetorical question, you guys just want to shout out the answer back. If we assume a business mindset to our work, for we employees, what is the good or service we are selling? It doesn't matter what industry, but all of us are employees, what good or service are we selling? Ourselves. Exactly. What's another maybe way of saying that? Our labor, okay? So here's what I'm suggesting. Some of these things, you see, they're mindset things. Someone's like, oh, I'm an employee, I'm not in business. What I'm actually suggesting is like, yes, you are. Your good or your service is your labor. And this is, we don't have to denigrate that, but we recognize that, okay? So yes, it's your labor. We're trading our time for money, which this is one of the biggest arguments, by the way, for pursuing business ownership. From the perspective of a business owner, it's just a fact that this is one of the most inefficient means of producing real substantive wealth. So if we want to increase, for those of us who are employees, we just got this question, I'm asking you guys this. If we want to increase the volume of our good or service, what do we have to do? If we're selling our labor, what do we have to do to increase the volume of our good or service? Work more, exactly. So again, that is not the most efficient or desirable conclusion from the business-minded perspective. On the other hand, we can also increase the value of our labor, and therefore its price. This means investment in your skill as a worker. This is a better direction to focus your energy on rather than increasing your time. At the very least, a man should focus on increasing his equivalent hourly rate of pay over time by becoming a more skilled laborer. Another way an entrepreneurial mindset would affect the employee, again, as long as that's our station in life where God has us, it should impress upon him that he should not think, at least in one sense, he should not think of his job as his exclusive or perhaps even his primary form of building wealth, or I should be more specific and say building assets. There's another argument for business ownership, is that a business owner can pass on his business to his descendants, or he can sell it, whereas employees typically can't pass on their employment to their children. A business is an asset, while mere employment is not. Employees ultimately increase the value of another family's business asset. So I think employees should think of their job, one way is to think of it as a means of buying family assets. And so when we think of what business we're in, we don't necessarily think first of our job, but rather of the primary assets we invest in. Those are what we can be passed on onto the next generation. And I'll just say this, I don't mean to be any disrespectful or funny, but it was occurring to me earlier today, for a lot of families, from this perspective, you can say, what business are we in? We're in the 401k business, which doesn't sound, we don't probably like to hear that, but it might be true. But if that maybe changes, think, well, if that, say, I need to do something different, it's probably a good thing. Okay, so now how many people, I know Jeff Bakken has been talked about earlier today. How many people have heard Jeff Bakken's teaching on the quadrivocational mission? A few hands over here. Good. Okay. He basically makes a similar point here using different terminology. The quadrivocational mission is basically encouraging sons to adopt these four identities as part of what it means to become a man. And this is his terminology. He says a man is an estate manager, a business resource developer, a nation builder, and an ecclesiastical shepherd. Well, I'm focusing on the first two here. Having an identity as an estate manager and business resource developer, rather than, say, a mere student or a worker when a boy transitions from puberty to manhood, is what we want to instill in our young men. And what this does is that a boy learns, part of what it means to be a man is to be an estate manager and a business resource developer, and listen to this, regardless of the particular situation he finds himself in. It doesn't matter what kind of job he is in or is not doing. It doesn't matter if he's even unemployed. It doesn't matter if he's a student. Those variations in life are just that, variations. But he's always building an estate. It's just part of what it means to be a man. You're a man, you're building an estate. You might be doing it poorly at the moment, but it doesn't remove that as an identity and a dominion task. And this also applies for we more seasoned men who are employed. We need to adopt this identity as well. Okay, so that was just one suggestion for what an entrepreneurial culture might look like in a family. So a second idea for what an entrepreneurial culture would look like in a family is that they identify and invest in the more proven entrepreneurs of the family. So rather than have a goal that every son in each generation is to build a massive fortune from scratch through their entrepreneurial endeavors, instead of that, have a goal as an extended family that at least one family business will be successful and that can employ a lot of family members and others. Now, and those that are not as entrepreneurially gifted can invest in and support the one, two, or however many gifted family members. It just may be an unnecessary burden to ask every child, every nuclear family, to be a successful business creator. However, to ask us of an entire extended family is much more reasonable and feasible. Okay, the following are two quotes from James Hughes Jr. that I think supports this idea of a distinction between building an entrepreneurial culture, but not necessarily a culture of entrepreneurs. Up here. He says, this is on the entrepreneurial side. A family that starts its long-term wealth preservation planning by adopting the metaphor that it is a business will begin with a wonderful psychological tool. If a family thinks it is in business to enhance the lives of its individual members, it discovers the most powerful form of preservation thinking it can do. But then we have, from the same author, we have this quote. A family that imagines, or worse, assumes that every member of the family will be a wealth creator, or even that in every generation someone will have the creative instinct to be a great financial wealth creator, is fooling itself. Such a family is in entropy and will swiftly go out of business. I recently finished a book on the Rockefeller family, a big 800-page book, and I've heard this comment from more than one author talk about this phenomenon. Most of us are aware that John D. Rockefeller Sr., the first generation, built the massive fortune. He had one son, Jr. Jr. had five sons. Rockefeller Jr., he did not go into the family business, the oil building business, in terms of really developing his father's footsteps in there. Instead, he worked on building the family. He had interest on what the money could do to cultivate the family. And he wasn't a savvy business person like his father was. And multiple people have talked that if it wasn't for that, the Rockefeller family, what we know, the reputation today, would not be what it is. This is the generation where you have the Mellons and the Carnegies. The Mellons and Carnegies do not have the influence that the Rockefellers did. And so this sometimes it's just to kind of prove the point. If Junior was more money finance minded, it probably would have been dissipated and went elsewhere. So this is one of those. It's not necessarily intuitive that we need to hear that. It's not just about focusing on the financial expertise. So. So here's one last quote on this subject that I want to share that I hope may be a source of inspiration for us to see what's possible. This is a quote from my friend that I mentioned to you, Jeremy Pryor, in his ebook titled Refamily, A Biblical Blueprint. And Phil, he did not steal that from you. It's his own thing, so Biblical Blueprint. By the way, I think, guys, if anyone's taking notes, go ahead and write down this website, familyteams.com. Familyteams.com is a website that my friend Jeremy Pryor has, where he has a lot of practical tools and information about multi-generational family building. All right. In our community, there are three ways families make additional streams of income through new businesses. The first is being an entrepreneur who starts new businesses. The second is being a great partner to an entrepreneur who is starting a new business. And the third is taking over a growing business an entrepreneur has started, but no longer has the energy or expertise to continue developing. In each case, what the family asks for is equity, a percentage of ownership in the business, and not just income. Remember, the goal is not to land a better job, but to help your family achieve financial independence. In our community, the average number of years to independence through business ownership is under 5 years, and financial independence through more passive instruments is taking only 10 to 15 years. This is because, and this is the point I want you guys to hear and see here, this is because the greatest single thing any family could do to cut in half the time it takes to reach financial independence is to be part of an entire Christian community that is on the same path. So an additional thing for us to notice here, we talked about earlier about this aspect of community. In that previous session on family discipleship, we talked about the need for a family to surround itself with a strategic community. Do you have a question?
What community
So yep, I'll do the brief version of it, and you can ask me for details at the break. Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky area, and by now it's getting close to 20 years ago, maybe 15 to 20 years ago. A handful, they were in the home church kind of community, and this was one of their values that they came together as a community of financial independence. And they had a couple of gifted entrepreneurs who made it an intention to train their families to transition to business ownership. And this, it's a good testimony. Proportionally, as a community of how many families, well over 50%, maybe about 70% of them have sustainable businesses, and some of them are becoming wealthy because they have a multi-generational vision. So, in a nutshell, it's a community that started a little less than 20 years ago in the Cincinnati area that they're doing this. So anyway, well, this idea that's very strategic to surround ourselves with a community that's on the same path. Another perfect example of this power of community. We need them, and not just our own families. Okay, this is not necessarily this next slide, building family wealth. Better if it's built slower and it's hard to build. So not necessarily an intuitive idea here, so it is important that you hear and understand it. For multi-generational families, the longer it takes to build your wealth, and the harder it is to build your family wealth, the better. Now, this is one of those principles that I learned from the actual wealthy multi-generational families say over and over again. Now, if your first reaction is that this doesn't make initial sense, just suspend judgment for a moment. And although this should sound familiar, recall Proverbs 13:11. Wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it. Well, what do you know? It turns out that those who have observed multi-generational families have found that this is actually the case in real life. So let me say this in another way. The principle is that the faster wealth is made and the easier wealth is made, the quicker and easier it is to lose. And of course, the opposite is true. The longer it takes to make and the harder it is to make, the longer it tends to stick around. So if this is true, and I had a question here, but I think I'll just comment on it. One thing as a recommendation for extended families, you're going to have all this mixture thing. There's going to individual families are going to have employment, other individual businesses. It may be the case that one of your family members builds a bigger business. It would be strategic for as an extended family to have as a goal of building one larger common family business that is intentionally meant to be a multi-generational family business. Because like a lot of these things, even apart from a profit perspective, et cetera, things that keep families together, external trends that keep families stuck together. A business is strategically one of the most strategic things that keeps families together. So even apart from income needs or this, that, and that, just as a project, it is a very strategic tool. So for those kind of businesses, I'd recommend, if you take just an individual family man, he needs income this year, right? Cash flow now, and appropriately so. That's one kind of thing. As a multi-generational family, given this principle, I guess here I'm going to ask you, what kind of business or investments would be strategic in the long term? It's kind of an obvious rhetorical question, but maybe just interact. I want to hear what you guys... Think of it in go ahead. Or someone raise your hand.
Mm-hmm. We pretty much know we're going to be needed for the long term.
Yeah. Good. Here's an example, I mean, where the counterintuitive, where I don't necessarily contrast on an individual level. From an individual level, a lot of time we have, and rightfully so, we might build a business with, hey, long term, I want to get to where I have more time freedom, okay? A little more hands off, and that's totally appropriate. But here's a principle for a multi-generational family business they talk about. It's better if it takes a lot of hands-on work. You don't want it to go passive. Going passive tends to dissipate things. So I'm not saying don't overdo this or extend it, but that's what they talk about. You want something that it keeps people involved and very active. So that's the harder aspect. So, good. One last thing on this point I want to say is with this principle is that this hit me one day when I was researching and thinking about this. If this is true, now something I'm assuming most of us have enough, you know, character integrity, we don't play the lotto. But maybe some of us entertain the idea, you know, but if someone gave me a ticket and I won, wouldn't that be pretty cool? It someday that when it is, if you have the mentality, you don't want that. That is an absolute threat to your family. If you do not, building money slowly, you don't appreciate it. You do not want that. So, and maybe that's just a little perspective thing. Is that idea is being a big liability to your long-term family. Okay, so the next three topics I'm going to introduce, and I'm literally just going to introduce. I don't have the time, nor for that matter, the expertise to dive into them more deeply. And I do want to put them on your radar. So these would be in the category of sophisticated or advanced tools that your family over time will want to develop proficiency in. Okay, and the first advanced tool is to build a family bank. This is not a literal bank in the sense that it is registered with the government as a banking institution. However, it is a growing source of funds that can be used for the extended family for purposes that the extended family council decides on. The family bank should have a contribution policy and a distribution policy. The contribution policy is the decision of how do extended family households contribute to capitalizing the family bank over time, and the distribution policy answers the question of what the expenditures of the extended family bank should be. So I'd recommend, here's the first are our main categories, just to consider. You can have, this would be your own family's decision here. But loans or investments in new family business ventures. Emergency funds for family crises. If you guys want to comment on this too, we're saying, well, there's a lot of things we're not saying in here. You know, we talk about spheres, and this is an extended family. The nuclear family, the head of a household, is the primary responsibility of this family. So this would be after those things are met. Three, extended family business retreats. And four, qualified extended family mission objectives. So one of the main reasons to build an extended family bank is that as a multi-generational family, you want to become less and less dependent on our current corporate, the fiat-based banking system. I think this, again, we're not going into the subject. I know many people in this room know that is debt-based from the foundation up. And we're dependent on it, most of us. So for extended families to be strong, they must be independent. And so this is, I talked in the break, needing to build alternative institutions and forms. And so this is one form of doing that. Okay, so I'm curious, how many people, I think I have it up there, the infinite banking concept. How many people have heard of that idea, that phrase? Go fill and get, whoa, okay. I'm honestly a little reluctant to even bring this up because I don't have the time to try to fully explain this, but it can be a little bit counterintuitive at first. So I'll state the basic concept here without fully explaining it, and then again, you can ask me later for more details. The idea is using a particular kind of whole life insurance policy that after you have spent several years building up the cash value to use the borrowing feature to finance larger purchases like cars, down payments, or investment opportunities. This whole life policy loan works in a way that your principal stays intact, which means you never interrupt the compounding interest. And if an objection is occurring to your mind right now saying that, oh, we should never borrow, you can ask me about these two terms later. Ask about net versus gross debt. And the second, the idea that we finance everything we buy. Those are not intuitive concepts, but they go into this. So I'll have to leave it at that for now as a teaser. I know that is not enough information to fully understand this. But again, I wanted to introduce this subject to you so it's something you will follow up on your own. It's currently one of the better strategies that I've run into in terms of becoming less dependent on our current banking system. Okay, next advanced tool is this thing called Dynasty Trust. So this quote, own or principle of own nothing but control everything. If you haven't heard that phrase before, it's considered one of the secrets of the wealthy. As multi-generational families, we've talked about how wealth is the fuel of the family. Biblically, covenantal families are obligated to pass their wealth to their covenantally faithful descendants and not to the state. The problem is, in today's world, you can't just decide to give all your wealth to your descendants upon your death. The state wants their cut. The last time I checked, this was several years ago. I think it's changed since then, but the estate tax was, I think, around 55% for everything over $5 million. And if your first thought is that that's not a problem for you and I, middle-class, humble folk, if you're thinking that, you're thinking monogenerationally again. What is supposed to happen over time, what is supposed to happen over time in a multi-generational family? So your descendants ideally should be leveraging the investment made into them and increasing their wealth. So eventually they will be the targets of excessive estate taxes. So is there a way to avoid this kind of taxation? And the answer is yes, and is primarily, though definitely not exclusively, the use of trusts. And specifically for on the multi-generational scale, what is called a dynasty trust. So in essence, what is happening here is by giving up the privilege of ownership of assets, you are no longer taxed for those assets as an individual. You're giving something up when you transfer money to a trust. You can't thereafter just spend it on anything your heart desires. But if this is money, resources that you intended to go to your heirs anyway, why not give up ownership of it now or before your death? This is where the principle of own nothing, control everything comes from. You still control the money in the sense that it is going where you want it to go, in this case, your descendants. But once it has been dedicated to them through the trust, you can't just take it back for other purposes. Otherwise, you wouldn't be legally transferring the right of ownership. All right, here's the last advanced tool before the last one that I want to introduce to you as something that's called the Five Flag Strategy. The Five Flag Strategy is about internationalizing your assets. And the reason for this is something called sovereign risk. Now, most of us are familiar with traditional investment risk categories such as market risk, liquidity risk, inflation risk, etc. But the biggest risk that the high net worth multi-generational families face is this thing called sovereign risk. Sovereign risk is basically the threat that governments pose to families of substantive wealth. The primary threat is through excessive taxation, of course. But other threats include overregulation of their businesses to outright confiscation of some of their assets. So the strategy that wealthy families use to minimize or mitigate this risk is to diversify different aspects of their family internationally. They plant these following five flags, so to speak, in five different countries that make the most sense for that particular flag. And so here the five flags are: one, their primary banking institution; their primary or secondary residence; their primary or secondary citizenship; the bulk of their investable assets; and finally, the location of their business and corporation. So different countries are better or worse for each of those criteria. And once again, before you start thinking that this kind of stuff doesn't apply to you as a middle-class wage earner, I need to remind you, I'm not talking about you as an individual household. Okay, you're thinking monogenerational again. I'm talking about your extended family clan 100 years or 200 years from now. You individually perhaps can afford to ignore this stuff, but they can't. And you are the one that needs to begin studying, planning, and planting vision for this. Imagine, I want you to imagine your extended family multi-generationally over the next 200 years. A few households are going to be successful entrepreneurs and wealth builders, but most are going to be modest earners like the rest of us. But now picture all the income your future family will earn over those 200 years. How much of it will go to the state versus being kept and reinvested in and through your family? In the long term, ignoring sovereignty risk is just, it's really bad stewardship, okay? So, something to think about. All right, here's our last subject, the proto-family office idea. So here's the quote I read a few years ago that prompted me to explore what I'm calling a proto-family office. Again, from the book by Bill and Will Bonner. He said, poor people have food stamps and bail bonds. The middle class has Social Security and Medicaid. Rich people have family offices. So this quote got my attention, and I intuitively sense that this is an idea that aspiring, covenant-minded families need to explore, and that there were principles from this that could be applied to our pre-wealth families. So first, what is a family office? Probably the best way to describe them is to look at the historical forces that create them. First of all, only what are called ultra-net-worth families have true family offices. These are not your average rich families. In today's dollars, these families' minimum net worth is in the $30 to $50 million range, and that's a minimum. Without that kind of net worth base, it is not cost-effective to start a family office. So why do these families start this new entity called a family office? Well, prior to their family office, they had their investments handled by a wealth management firm over here. They had their taxes handled by a separate firm specializing in tax management over here. And they had their legal services handled by a separate law firm. So as their wealth grew, it became increasingly necessary to coordinate these different spheres. In other words, there was an incentive to bring all these different specialties under one roof, so to speak. Second, they experienced conflict of interest problems. These professional firms served several different wealthy families. They had their own shareholders to please as their priority and used their own investment philosophies. So these ultra-net-worth families began experiencing that the ultimate interest of these other professional firms often did not align with their own best interests. So it soon occurred to these wealthy families that they could afford to form their own professional service firms to serve just their families, and that way they eliminated the conflict of interest problem. Third, as these families became increasingly wealthy, they realized they had an increasing privacy problem. These other professional service firms held a lot of the family's private information. They became vulnerable to stealing, fraud, blackmail, and threats to their reputation. In other words, they had an increasing trust problem. So once again, the solution, bring these services in-house. Fourth, as everyone in the investing world knows, the best investments are only available to the qualified wealthy. To get access to the, or to keep access in one sense to the best investment opportunities, these families had to incorporate and register with the government as professional accredited investors. And finally, in addition to these financial and legal reasons, let me just remember that in addition to these financial legal reasons, this is what makes them different than wealth management firms, these ultra net worth families found they needed to institutionalize two other areas, their charitable giving and the education of the next generation of family members. So the family office became the tool to address these other areas as well. So you and I can't afford to start a family office. We don't have $50 million laying around. But I want you to notice something. What are the structural pieces of a family office? You have investments, mitigation of tax and legal threats, and the education of the next generation. And where they typically, in these books, these families, they talk about philanthropy for reasons that I don't have time to get into now. You could ask me later. I would substitute the idea of mission for that. So these are all the things we've talked about that families aspiring to build a family dynasty must pursue. So structurally, we need to be doing the same thing. The only difference is we don't have the big money yet. But I don't think that's an ultimate problem. In the long term, and here's why. You've all heard of the proverb, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. For over 95% of wealth founders, and I'm talking about the ultra net worth founders, the big family money is spent and gone in three generations. The fourth generation is just like the rest of us economically, in terms of their capacity. So this should tell you that for families who persist with wealth beyond the third generation, it wasn't money that kept the family money intact. And the fourth generation cousins were not fortune founders like your John D. Rockefeller or Bill Gates. Well, Bill Gates, we haven't gotten there yet, but like the John D. Rockefeller family. What kept the family money intact, in a word, is a multi-generational family culture and disciplines. In other words, you and I are the same as those fourth generation cousins. If we do the same kinds of things they are doing, we can build an ultra net worth extended family estate in due time. It would probably take at least 100 years, probably 150 years, even under the best conditions. But that's okay, we have the time. So the proto in my coined phrase, proto family office, is to indicate that extended families who are aspiring dynasty builders should engage in each of the structural pieces of a traditional family office. Investments, tax and legal mitigation, mission expenditures, and most importantly, education of the next generation. And they need to engage in these in ways that are available to them in their stage of financial maturity. For example, with investments, an extended family of modest means can start out with forming a limited liability company to invest in securities or real estate together. But in 50 years, things like hedge funds and private equity deals should be just one part of your family investment portfolio, or at least you have the ability to look at those things. You're not ready for it now, but you can build your way there. A lot of families have that rich uncle somewhere in the extended family. With a proto-family office, I'm suggesting that you take 100 to 150 years to build that rich uncle. It's not the most important tool, but I'm convinced your future family will need something like this to help it grow its mission in future generations. Here's the last thing. With just your own extended family, Lord willing, and again, I say under the best conditions, this would probably take more than 100 years. Is there a way to speed that up? I think the answer is yes. So how? I think the answer is by teaming up with other like-minded families and creating what is called a multi-family office. So recall I mentioned earlier that families who have less than $50 million in investable assets typically can't afford to start a family office. So what do those poor saps who only have a measly $10 to $20 million do? That's right, they join together to create a multi-family office so they have a sufficient base to afford it. But remember, one of the reasons for creating a family office is trust. This only works with sufficiently like-minded families who trust each other. So this is something that I intend to explore over the next several years. That is how aspiring covenant-minded families can begin pursuing this kind or similar kind of projects together. I think it is worthy of investigation. So in that, my brothers and sisters, that concludes this presentation and the whole conference. So with that, want to come up? Do we have time for questions? Or
yes, we do. We have. We could take up to 15 minutes for questions. So, go ahead, Brian.
So on the
yeah. So it's quite. I thought I heard someone else. Correct me if I'm not quite getting around. So you said, as far as the family bank idea, what am I talking about specifically? Is it a cash under the mattress? Is it a cash
account?
Is it a bank account? So here, the first part of the answer is it's you have to start with it actually as an abstraction, because it can take, so what form does it take? Before it takes a form, Think of the principle. The idea is it's a source of collecting funds as an extended family. And as we know, that can be gold in the, you know, in a pit in the backyard. So at this point, I think it's also the principle we talked about. What you do at the beginning is going to be commensurate with your kind of family. What kind of resources do you have? Right? It's going to be very different from a family who gets this idea that they're already a very wealthy family. It's going to have a different form than myself or others. So I'll just, and quite, maybe this is another subject, and I was talking to a gentleman earlier today, I forgot your name, it's a financial advisor, where we actually, I need input of from some of the financial experts for a path. So, you know, there might be like two or three options, and so, you know, what option? But, you know, something as simple as forming, like I mentioned, you could form a limited liability company that could be for investments, all right? And you just start pooling money in there, and when you're ready to invest in a real estate property, you can do that, some securities. So that would be one form for those of us that are a little lower on the rung. We could start there. But still have, we talked about that governance. One of the more important thing is, what is this thing for, okay? So I don't know if that's kind of a hard question. I don't have one thing, but worthy of discussion, so. Yes? Good question. So if I can summarize it, it's just as the family grows over time, gets bigger and bigger, more diverse, does it ever split? Is that how you said it? Okay. Again, like a lot of these things, I'll kind of have maybe two aspects to this. This is where I get a little nerdy myself. I start thinking about it, and you actually run into a lot of pragmatic problems when you think of the fourth generation. It gets really complex, and what to do about it. Generally speaking, I would say you for that, I don't think there's maybe just one way to do it, but there's wiser ways to do it. And I think, yeah, as the family gets bigger, you should actually have a policy of how we are going to split and divide. And there's more than one way to do that. There's problems on both ends. You don't want a monolithic one, the big tribe and no other distinctions in between. It has its own problems. It comes with complexity. But like I said, sometimes we think about, I think it's foreign to us when we think about the complexity of this as a family. But as soon as we go a global corporation, think of Microsoft, it has to be complex to be that big. And that, so it's okay. So I don't know if that answered very well is, yes, splitting, and then you're going to have lots of governing documents that talk about how it all works. Sorry, a little bit over. If anyone wants to jump in on these questions as well, that they can have some insight on. But. Any other questions?
You got one over there.
I have two questions. One is...
I have to do kind of simplistic answer, because like a lot of things, this takes a long conversation to kind of fully get. And let me know maybe afterwards if I didn't quite answer your question. But yeah, it's an actual whole life policy. And the phrase I'm going to repeat there, you heard me say, it doesn't interrupt compounding interest. It's one of the few tools where you can let that vehicle continually compound, and it's just one of the best tools you can use to do this. And so, do you want to clarify? Yeah.
A follow-up question to that is, I think what they probably heard is if you're doing life insurance or term life insurance versus whole life insurance, what makes the most sense for life insurance is different than whole life investment.
Yeah, maybe that's what you're getting. And this gets a little abstract, but you're actually using this product. It actually is a life insurance product. You get life insurance, but the whole term, that's not what, this is for a family bank and more an investment tool is what it's for. So think of it more as it's a financial instrument instead of doubles as a whole life policy as well. Your second question, and you brought it, you got this is good. I can tell you intuit some of the tricky things. I'm trying to remember the second part of your question was. Yep. Okay. So the question had to do with imagine there's four siblings, extended family. Hey, we want to do this thing. One of them makes, $40,000 a year and has, $20,000 net worth. Another one's a millionaire. Right? Very disparate. And here's, like a lot of things, there isn't, I don't think, a simple answer. This goes back to governance, is you have to make decisions. So I'll give it an opinion level. Closer to equitability is having caps that if you're a really wealthy family member, not letting them contribute more into the extended family. And part of this also goes in jurisdiction. That should be for his line anyway, not for the broader line. You might have other policies where the extended council might allow for larger contributions, but the difference would be that all the siblings from the least economically wealthy to highest would decide together. You touched on a subject where that would be a problem. You can see that like this, but it's a decision that an extended family council would have to make. But I'd go in the direction of keeping it a little more equitable and letting, if you have that one or two much more wealthy individuals, that actually bulk of that goes to down their descendants rather than horizontally. That makes sense.
Let's go with one more question, if anybody has one more.
Sure, I'll just speak with the first thing that's coming to mind. I'm not sure if I'm directly getting at your what you're asking, so you can clarify. I think some of us know that's a good observation. I think similar to my point, I thought like we're looking at a lot of secular authors for maybe some ideas. You guys, we have to, as American Westerners, we're like the worst for this stuff, okay? But we know this. A lot of, I think, Asian cultures more particularly. And here's some examples I've read about. I'll just give a particular example. Here in America, we have the Chinatowns. Why do Chinatowns exist? Look into this. When they first started coming over, all the disadvantages they had as, minorities, discriminated against, et cetera, what did they do? All the families in a community bound together. They did their own banking. They helped each other out, and they became successfully viable in two or three generations. So they did it. They're actually practiced. And I talked about that some of this is instinctual in families, but they also had that was already built into their culture. It was kind of like, we got to apply this now here. We actually really need it. So, there's other examples where historical cultures where it is more easy for them because it's already part of the culture, but it can be lost as well. So, anyway, you can ask me more later if you want to get some other ideas. So, that was it for time. So, thank you, everyone. It's been a great day.
Thank you.